Thank you so much for being here in this warm evening. We'll try to heat it up even more. It is really, really wonderful to be here at Town Hall. This institution, these conversations are well known all over the country for keeping the intellectual juices flowing, for being a really critical part of the debate, and I'm really honored to be able to join with all of you. And thank you, Edward, for the introduction. I've had other introductions I didn't like quite as much. As he mentioned, I was President Bill Clinton's chief speechwriter once after a State of the Union address I'd worked on. I was especially proud of the work I'd done. I was talking to someone after the speech, and he came over and put his arm around me, and he said, "This is Michael. He's the guy who typed my speech." So I like that introduction better. It was accurate, but not complete. And you all are very, very lucky, as I hope you know, to get to hear tomorrow from Eric Liu, who was a policy aide as well as a foreign policy and domestic policy aide, and advisor and thinker, as well as speechwriter for President Clinton, and has continued to help shape the way we all think about citizenship and the economy and so many other things. As Edward mentioned, I wear several hats, and I am the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. And the Brennan Center is a law and policy institute, a nonpartisan organization that focuses on reforming and improving the systems of democracy and justice. And our premise is, if you want to solve the problems, you have to fix the systems. We were started by the clerks and family of Justice Brennan when he left the Supreme Court 2 decades ago. We take some of our mission from his spirit that the Constitution should protect human dignity as a central value. We're deeply engaged in the fight to protect voting rights. Our work saved the right to vote for as many as 5 million people in the last election, for campaign finance laws to curb the corrosive power of big money, for common sense bipartisan reform on criminal justice, where there are some really exciting opportunities bringing together left and right to deal with mass incarceration, a whole host of issues. And so we have at the front, sign up if you're interested in receiving any of the emails and publications we churn out. We're eager to keep in touch, so please feel free to sign up. No spam, only voluntary signups sought. As part of the work we do, what I try to understand is how we, the people, how we Americans grapple with and shape our Constitution, this remarkable document, this remarkable set of principles that we think about in this country so much more than other people in other countries think about their charter. And of course, this topic of the Second Amendment is one of the most burning, controversial, contentious, and current debates around the Constitution today and for a long time, although interesting, not always, throughout the country's history. And I wanted to understand, in writing this book, how does legal change actually happen in America? How does constitutional change happen? How do we understand what that Constitution means? And how do we all play a role in shaping it? And as I'm sure you all no, the Second Amendment is only 27 words long. It's the shortest sentence in the Constitution. It reads, a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. 27 words. What a lot of people don't know, even people who care passionately about this issue, don't realize, is that the Supreme Court never ruled that the Second Amendment recognized an individual right to gun ownership until 2008. 2008, it was really recent. In fact, previously, repeatedly, they'd ruled otherwise. And Justice Antonin Scalia, who wrote the majority opinion, I'm hearing some noise, but some feedback in the sound system. I love to talk about it. They ruled otherwise repeatedly. And Justice Scalia, the author of the majority opinion in District of Columbia versus Heller, he was very proud of the opinion, and he said it reflected, it was the apogee, the vindication, he said, of his approach of originalism, that the only legitimate way to understand a constitutional provision is to ask what it meant to the framers and what it meant to their generation. And that's the way to do it. And this was his big opportunity to use that approach, and he saw it as the vindication. So looking at the history, looking at how we've looked at the Second Amendment, turned out to be pretty relevant to understanding it. And there were, to me, surprises at every step of the way. Surprises for people who consider themselves advocates of gun rights, and surprises for people who consider themselves advocates of gun control or gun safety laws. The story is twists and turns, and not necessarily what you expect. And the thing that turned out to be the case, at least in my reading of it, is that the way we Americans have understood the Second Amendment has never been about some pristine text. It's always been the push and pull of public agitation, political organizing, and public debate. That's always the way it's been from the beginning. In fact, that's the way it always is with all constitutional provisions. And it's always been the case when it comes to the Second Amendment that, to a surprising degree, individual rights and individual responsibility have gone hand in hand from the beginning, from back to the founding era. So what were some of those surprises? What is that story? Why is it called a biography of the Second Amendment? Well, the story starts, well, at least where I started, way back in the East Coast, in the hills 16 miles outside of Boston, at Lexington and Concord, when the militias of those towns and of Massachusetts first did battle with King George's troops and fired the shot heard round the world, although we actually don't know who fired the shot. Somebody fired the shot heard round the world and launched the American Revolution. Because and that was pretty important, as it happens, to the story of the Second Amendment, because that was those Minutemen, that was the militia. And it turns out that to the framers, when you want to look at what they were focused on when they wrote that Second Amendment, the framers cared passionately about those militias. It was not, to them, throat clearing, the way we sort of imagine it might be now when we look at the part, the second half of the amendment, which is what we focus on so much. What were the militias? They were not like anything we know now. They were not like anything we have now. It wasn't the same as the National Guard, which we sort of think of as the grandchildren of those militias. The militia of the colonial era and the revolutionary era, every adult man, eventually every adult white man, was in the militia for their entire adult life, from age 16 to 60. And they were required by law to own a gun, and to keep it at home, and to bring it in for the militia service. This was sort of a proto-democracy. It was the way people participated in the civic life of their community. There were no police forces, there was no army, there was basically no cities. This was how people participated. And the militias were not just this kind of military force, but it was really at the heart of a political philosophy that was very important to the framers and to the revolutionaries of America. They thought not only were these valuable, but they were a bulwark against tyranny. They were the way to protect, to check the power of what they feared more than anything else, which was a standing army. What was a standing army? Well, the King George's Redcoats, that was a standing army. Standing army was a professional military force, paid, commanded by the king, that could be an agent of authoritarianism. And there was a whole political philosophy about militias and endless discussion of how important the militias were. Now, the reality was sometimes a little different. they fought well at Lexington and Concord. They didn't fight so well, actually, during the rest of the Revolution. There were people like George Washington who grew pretty cynical pretty quickly about the militias, who actually thought our new country needed an army. But the public reverence for the militias was really strong. When the Revolution ended, the British sailed away. The country, as we know, faced a lot of issues of military power, but it also began to fall apart. It began to drift toward what we would now call a failed state during the Articles of Confederation period. So during time of violence, of mob violence and Shays' Rebellion, as we all learned in high school history, and where a mob in Western Massachusetts refused to obey the orders of the courts, and the militia was sent by the governor, and they took a vote and switched sides. The militia members elected their officers, and they took a vote before going into battle. The leading men of the states went behind closed doors in Philadelphia and held what we call now, of course, the Constitutional Convention, and debated quite considerably these issues of military power and what we should do with the militias, with these revered institutions of citizen soldiers keeping their weapons, their personal weapons. How should that fit into the new order of the Constitution? So when the Constitution got released, you all know, it thrust much more strongly toward a more powerful central government. And when it was released to the public, it was wildly controversial. It was perhaps the greatest debate we've ever had in this country, as people argued for and against. Many, many Americans were really afraid that this new government was going to be tyrannical. And one of the things they were afraid of was that it allowed there to be a standing army, and that they were afraid that that standing army could crush those 13 state militias made up of citizen soldiers with their guns from home. And that was one of the things they were debating. And as you know, when the Constitution rolled from state to state getting ratified, what wound up happening was eventually it got ratified by every state, but after about halfway through, people said, well, we're going to ratify it, but we want you to do some amendments. And states sent in dozens and dozens of contradictory amendments on all different kinds of topics, only a few of them touching on the militia. But this was the way they got it passed. And that fear of those militias being crushed by the new government was what led directly to the Second Amendment. James Madison played a really interesting role. I had a lot of fun learning or relearning the story of Madison as one of the founders and fathers of our constitutional system. He, of course, was the mind behind our system of government. He took the notes at the Constitutional Convention. He organized the campaign along with the other young men who had served mostly in the army, not in the militia, who were pushing for the new Constitution. He, of course, co-authored with Hamilton and Jay the Federalist Papers, all of which argued we shouldn't amend the Constitution. And then he ran for Congress in the very first congressional election. And his bitter, bitter political archenemy, Patrick Henry, had it in for Madison. He gerrymandered the district. This was 20 years before Elbridge Gerry signed his name to a district and gave us gerrymandering. They gerrymandered Madison before Gerry. The only part of his congressional district that was pro-Constitution was basically his house. He was bookish and diffident and an intellectual. They ran against him a not-too-bright war hero with a British musket ball in his lung, James Monroe, who was against the Constitution and wanted amendments. And it turned out that the farmers of that district would definitely rather drink a cider with Monroe than with Madison in today's terms. And it turned out that the swing vote made all the difference. The swing vote in that district were the Southern Baptists. Now today, of course, Southern Baptists are a reliably conservative voting bloc. Then they were the religious dissidents. And they felt that they had been oppressed by the Episcopalians of their district. It's actually true. They taxed them. And so they said to Madison, we'll vote for you, but only if you switch your position on amendments and come out for a religious freedom amendment. So James Madison was who was against the, as we would say today, he was against the Bill of Rights before he was for it. Madison executed the first great flip-flop in American political history, issued this statement about how, well, it's true, I was always against amendments, but things have really changed now, and I really meant it all. My position is completely consistent now with what it was, the opposite, last week, and tens of thousands of politicians have followed that approach since. I work for a few. And I won't say which ones. And he switched his position, came out for amendments, vowed, made a read my lips promise to pass them, and he won by 339 votes. Then he got to Congress, so then he had to go pass the Bill of Rights. And he got to Congress and nobody cared. Because they'd all gotten elected saying no amendments. And for Madison and the other members of Congress, it was something of a sop to the public. Madison eventually argued, saying this was necessary, these amendments were necessary to deal with the psychological distemper of the public that was irrationally fearful of all this stuff. He got up, and June 8th of 1789, he proposed 20 amendments. 20 amendments. Not the 10 amendments like the Decalogue that we know now. They ranged in topic from the size of congressional districts to congressional pay to this amendment dealing with military power, as well as it was the Fifth Amendment, and also the amendment next to it dealing with the quartering of troops and homes, and the other things, of course, that we know of as the Bill of Rights. It was debated. They marked it up. It was written more or less by Madison's approach was taken. It went into committee. It was Congress. We don't have C-SPAN, but it wasn't all very pretty, and they came out eventually with the 10 amendments now that we now know. And they were sent off to the states for ratification. And there's almost no evidence of any debate after that. We can find very little evidence of them even talking about the Second Amendment or the other parts of the Bill of Rights as they were ratified. So what did they mean? What was clear to me in reading and writing about this was, given the theory that you're supposed to draw your understanding of the Constitution based now on what they meant then, was that a lot of them meant different things. And there's the fog of history. It's really hard to know what they meant. But the fact of the matter is this, and this is striking given our intense debates today on individual gun rights. There, if you look at the notes from the Constitutional Convention, if you look with a few scattered exceptions at the records of the ratification conventions, if you look at the debate in the Congress over the Second Amendment, and 12 members of the House of Representatives spoke about it, there is not a word about an individual right to gun ownership for the things we think about now, self-protection, hunting, or other things like that. It was all focused on the political check involved in the militias. In fact, Madison's original proposal for the Second Amendment had a conscientious objector clause. It said if you are religiously scrupulous of bearing arms, you don't have to do your military service in person. That's what they were debating. So it's really striking as we try to look for answers for these debates today. It's very hard to find it. Now, I want to be very clear. It's very important. Certainly people ask this question a lot. There were a lot of guns in the United States, in the colonies and in the United States then. And Americans believed they had a right to use them. They believed they had a right to self-defense, especially in the home. This was a right handed down from England through common law. And if you read the great jurist Blackstone, he talks about the right of self-defense as being very important. But as a common law right, it was subject to limitations also. And there were, it turns out, a web of gun control laws, even in the colonies, even in the early American period. In Boston, it was illegal to keep a loaded gun in your home for safety reasons. In Philadelphia and other cities, you couldn't fire a gun in the city limits. Lots of states prohibited different kinds of people from having guns, people who were considered unusually dangerous, Tories, for example. There were all kinds of, you had to take a loyalty oath, all kinds of restrictions on gun ownership and gun practice. Which were seen then as completely consistent with the right of self-defense, which was, again, a common law right. and not what they were debating, at the least based on the record, not what they were talking about and debating when they talked about putting the Second Amendment in the Constitution. That is, in many respects, a surprise. Something funny happened right after that. That militia system, what they were so passionate about, what they memorialized, what they debated in the Constitutional Convention, what they memorialized in the Constitution, it started to crumble, started to fade away. What happened? People stopped showing up for militia duty. People were, they, 2 months after the Second Amendment was ratified, Congress passed a law requiring every white man to buy a gun. No one would do it because it was government telling me what to do. It was actually cited in the Obamacare case in front of the Supreme Court as another example where government ordered people to buy something in private commerce. The country changed. People started to realize the militias were not such a great instrument of defense. The War of 18, James Madison in Federalist Number 46 had written about the armed citizenry and the militias would be 500,000 strong and could protect the country. And then the British invaded during the War of 1812, brushed right past the Maryland militia and burned down James Madison's house, at the White House. And then after that, they stopped thinking the militias were going to be enough to protect the country. And the country changed too. It grew much more into the country we are today. It grew more individualistic. People didn't see their civic duty as being at the heart, but they saw their individual rights as being more paramount. I'm asked all the time, does it, when you look at the founding era, does it reflect an individual right of the militia? And the answer is both and neither. It reflected an individual right to fulfill the civic duty to serve in the militia. So our question to the founders would make no sense, just like their answer in many ways makes no sense. But then the country changed. It grew more individualistic. There were greater understanding that there would be gun rights and always this sense of individual responsibility and gun laws at the same time. Even in the Wild West, there's a wonderful photograph of Dodge City, Kansas, the archetypal Wild West town. It looks like it's in a movie. It's from the 1880s. It looks like you're at the Universal Studios back lot, you know, for the Western set. It's dusty Main Street and the saloon doors on both sides and the hitching posts and says, "Welcome to Dodge City. Firearms strictly prohibited." Dodge City. But the country changed, and a lot of states changed too. What we understood the right to be changed from this kind of civic right to an individual right. States that joined later, that was more explicit. Washington State, it was more explicit. The Constitution in Washington State is one of the only constitutions that explicitly refers to individual rights of gun ownership, as opposed to much more ambiguous. The early constitutions were clearly about a more collective right. Washington State refers to an individual right, and so do some of the other recent ones, but Washington sort of is quite distinct in that way. But all along, throughout most of the country, you had individual gun rights and gun ownership and gun laws, and the courts stayed out. The courts stayed out. Four times, the Supreme Court looked at the Second Amendment, and four times it declined to rule that it recognized an individual right to gun ownership. In 1939, 9-0. And that was the status quo. These issues of gun rights and gun responsibilities were debated in Congress, they were debated in legislatures, at the ballot box, in the public debate, but it wasn't something where people thought they had the ability to go to court and get a judge to overturn a law based on a reading of a constitutional amendment. The conventional wisdom, the consensus of the time, was articulated by the former Chief Justice of the United States, Warren Burger, rock-ribbed conservative appointed by Richard Nixon. In 1991, Berger said, "The idea that the Second Amendment recognizes an unlimited right to individual gun ownership is, quote, a fraud on the public." Warren Berger said that. That sounds like from ancient days, right? So what happened? What happened? What changed? That comes to the second surprise. What changed is the role of the NRA. The NRA, we all know that the NRA is an extremely effective force at the ballot box and in political debate. It turns out that the NRA, along with other groups, including the Second Amendment Foundation here in Belleville, are critical constitutional players as well. Now, the NRA was, it's been around for a long time. It was created after the Civil War by Union officers who were concerned that the Union troops had poor marksmanship, and they wanted to train them better. And it focused for a long time on training, on safety, on preparedness. It kind of wound up speaking for hunters and sportsmen. On the headquarters in Washington, D.C., on the wall outside, it had big letters about safety and training and sportsmanship. Then came 1977, and it turns out we all think about the massive social changes from the 1960s and the impact that they had. It turns out that the backlash to the 1960s in the 1970s in some ways is more important and is what we're living with now. The NRA had never been wild about gun laws, but it hadn't really done much to oppose them either. It actually testified for the first federal gun law in the 1930s when asked by a member of Congress, geez, there are provisions in the Constitution. Do you see any constitutional problem with any of this? The NRA representative said, none that we can think of. What happened? In 1977, the NRA made clear, after supporting some recent gun laws, that it was going to move its headquarters to Colorado to further signal a further retreat from politics. At the convention that year, it's known as the Revolt at Cincinnati. Activists, about 1,000 activists, many from the Second Amendment Foundation, but others as well, showed up, voted out the old leadership, voted in new leadership that was much more intense, much more ideological, much more doctrinaire, and emphatically focused on remaking the NRA as a constitutional crusade for this vision of the Second Amendment. And now, when you go to the NRA headquarters in Virginia, you go into the lobby, and there on the wall, in pride of place, is the text of the Second Amendment. But you have to look closely. It's edited. They just edited out the first half, the part about the well-regulated militia. There's two dots. There's not even three dots. There's two dots. And what the NRA and other gun rights advocates did was kind of wage a classic constitutional campaign. They started with scholarship to show what had really been meant. What did they really mean? What was the legacy from England of gun rights? Now, some of the scholarship was strong, and some of it I found, at least, to be quite flimsy. A lot of plucking of quotes from the founding fathers out of context in a way that would be familiar to the people who write movie posters. You know, one example, Thomas Jefferson. There's numerous law review articles take this quote from Thomas Jefferson. He says, "One loves to possess arms, the one hopes to never have to use them." Wow, that's a good one. This is supposed to show you what the Second Amendment meant to the framers. And you can still see that on the NRA website. You can buy a t-shirt with it. Well, but it's all online now, though. So you go and look and see what did Jefferson really say. He was writing to George Washington. He said, "Mr. President, remember that decision I made as Secretary of State that was so controversial? I think I'm going to get attacked for it. Could you send me back that batch of letters I gave you? I need to be prepared to respond. One loves to possess arms, but one hopes never to have to use them." Whoops. It turns out it was a metaphor, but you can still see it on the website or buy the t-shirt or find it in law review articles. There was way too much of that. That wasn't all. The gun rights community worked very hard to change public opinion so that it became the consensus view that, of course, the Second Amendment refers to an individual right. It elected politicians, of course, or held them accountable, changed the organs of government so that the Justice Department switched its position of decades in 2001 to say, no, in fact, the Second Amendment refers to an individual right. And then, and only then, did they go to court. So that when that case was finally brought up before the Supreme Court in 2008, it fell like a ripe apple from a tree. Wasn't even really all that controversial. And that is, by the way we make constitutional change in America. That's how the civil rights movement did it. It's how marriage equality is sweeping across the country right now. It's how groups like mine work on voting rights. It's how people I'm fighting against got us Citizens United and other cases from the Supreme Court that changed the doctrine a lot. They understood that it was important to win in the court of public opinion before you win in the court of law. So that was the story. That is the constitutional story. And then there was another surprise after that. What happened next? What happened next, in some ways, what we're living through now, is an even bigger surprise. So the Heller case, when you strip away all the finery of its originalism, and Scalia, I'm very critical of the case and how it was written and its pretense. And of the 64 pages in the majority opinion, 2 deal with what the framers actually were talking about, which was the militias. The rest takes the words keep and bear and arms out of order and out of context and looks at dictionaries and says, what does it mean in a dictionary from this period and that period? To me, it read like a Scrabble player trying really hard to prove that that triple square word really does exist, you know? And it's been criticized a lot by other judges, by conservative judges, who thought it was kind of loosey-goosey constitutionalism that they used to criticize liberals for doing. When you strip away the originalism, what did the Supreme Court actually say? What it said was this: yes, there's an individual right, but that right, like all rights, has limitations. That right, like all rights, implies responsibilities. And so there can be gun restrictions, gun laws, gun controls, and the opinion by Justice Scalia lists a bunch of them. Now, the court was kind of vague about what the right was. It was kind of vague about what the restrictions might be. It's thrown the question out to other judges and other courts. There have been dozens and dozens and dozens of lawsuits all across the country since 2008. And the overwhelming consensus is that these laws have been upheld against these challenges by federal judges all across the country. Yes, they say there's an individual right, but society too has a right to protect itself. There is a compelling governmental and public interest in strong gun laws. Now, not everywhere has had that ruling. In fact, one of the most controversial topics is being debated right now, actually in this federal judicial circuit. The question of how far does the Second Amendment extend to guns carried outside the home? The Supreme Court has never ruled on whether either concealed carrying or open carrying is constitutionally protected. Almost all the courts have upheld gun laws very, very strictly limiting carrying of weapons. Interestingly, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the most liberal circuit in the country, struck down California's gun law a few months ago in a case called Peruta. And that applies to this state and other states as well on the West Coast. It's probably the case that the full group of judges in the Ninth Circuit is going to hear that again. It could well be that that case goes up to the Supreme Court. But interestingly, most recently, 2 weeks ago, justices have been very, very reluctant to hear another big gun case. No one knows why. Maybe they think that the consensus that's developed is something they like. Maybe nobody knows how Justice Kennedy's going to vote, which is very possibly what the challenge is. Nobody knows. But they turn down opportunities to hear these cases. And many gun rights advocates have decried these judicial decisions, have said that they follow the reasoning of the dissent in Heller more than the opinion, have likened this consensus of these dozens of rulings to massive resistance, to the South's resistance to Brown versus Board of Education during the Civil Rights era. But that is one of the surprising and fascinating facts. Another surprising and fascinating fact has to do with the real-world political impact of this newly enshrined constitutional right. After the Newtown massacre, the horrific murder of those children in late 2012, the country once again began debating gun laws for the first time in almost 2 decades. And that was when I started writing the book after that. And the Congress, as you know, debated strengthening the background check system, the federal background check system. It was a bipartisan bill called Manchin-Toomey. It had a majority of the Senate, but it failed to overcome a filibuster. That proposal did not lose because it was decried or effectively debunked as violating the Second Amendment. Nobody really seriously argued that it violated the Second Amendment because the court had been so clear that the wrong kind of people, dangerous people, can be kept from getting guns and that laws can be effective to do that. It lost because of the political power of the NRA and other gun rights advocates. It lost because of the filibuster rule. It actually had a majority of the Senate. It didn't lose because of the Second Amendment. And there are actually people who say, well, this ruling by the Supreme Court will make it easier to get a consensus because there's an individual right. No one's going to take everyone's guns away. But we can also have restrictions. We can also have gun laws. There's another set of factors that suggest there might be eventually moves, even on this tense and intense issue, toward that kind of common sense consensus. You know, as you all know, there's almost 300 million guns in the United States. Much, much, much more than any other developed country. Nobody's going to take those guns away. Nobody's going to take those guns away, even if they wanted to. The number of guns is going up, but the ranks of gun owners is going down pretty dramatically. Fewer and fewer people have more and more guns. And fewer people, for example, are hunting. And the other longstanding purposes why people have guns. One can imagine that there are ways that this could ease as an issue. I was really struck, because a lot of the things that could actually make a difference to keep children from accidentally shooting themselves or others, to keep guns out of the hands of people that shouldn't have them, there are technological changes, there are technological fixes, there are legal approaches that don't come close to touching the Second Amendment that actually turn out to be things that can make a big difference. I was really struck 2 weeks ago by a statistic I heard, and this isn't in the book because it was much more recent. This year, for the first time, more Americans will be killed by firearms than by cars. 33,000 people. Now, at one level, that's a terrifying and horrifying statistic. Again, it's multiples more than other equally violent countries in Europe and elsewhere. But what's really interesting is actually why so few people are killed by cars. The number of people killed by cars is going down and down and down. Why is that? Cars used to kill a lot more people. Well, they didn't seize the cars. They didn't confiscate your car. They didn't take away your right to drive. They made cars safer. They put in airbags. They put in seat belts over the strenuous objection of the auto industry. But they did those things. They raised the drinking age. They lowered the speed limit. They put in all these sensors, that video camera in the back of the car that everybody now sees. I mean, all these things made cars safer. There are similar technological things that can help make guns safer. And so what I worry about is the idea that Second Amendment fundamentalism, the idea that somehow a misremembered history tells us that no restriction is ever permissible on any use of firearms or any ownership of firearms, and that you can go to a judge to enforce that can sideswipe and defeat the ability to reach toward that common ground. What is it that needs to be done? Part of what I argue in the end of the book is I think that one of the answers has to be who makes the decisions. I think that the people, that the right of the people as described in the amendment, that we the people in the preamble of the Constitution, we're the ones who always have decided what the Constitution means. The way the Second Amendment changed, the way the courts changed, as with all this other constitutional change we've seen, was always, again, a matter of public debate, public argument, public organizing at the ballot box in referendums like the ones we're seeing here in Washington State and elsewhere. That, to me, is the answer. People who want stronger gun laws, they ask me, what should they do? I say, take a page from the NRA and the other gun rights advocates. Be in it for the long haul. Understand that you have to win in the court of public opinion before you're going to win in the court of law. Take the cue from Abraham Lincoln, one of the great constitutional thinkers in our history, a great lawyer. He was arguing in the first Lincoln-Douglas debate in 1858. He was talking, of course, about slavery. And he said, with public sentiment, anything is possible. Without public sentiment, nothing is possible. Consequently, he who molds public sentiment has more power than a judge or a legislator, because they make it possible for those judges or legislators to act. That's how the gun issue has been, is, and will be debated and decided. So thank you for your patience. I'm eager to hear any questions or conversations.
I want to ask you a question of constitutional law when you were talking about originalism. I'm curious about the fact that, if I heard you right, the framers of the Constitution didn't get into the issue, as I heard it, of individual gun ownership, because it was assumed that people had a right to go hunting and have a gun in their home. So my question is, when people debate the Constitution or the Supreme Court, do they ever take into account the context of the times and why things may or may not be in the Constitution? And there may be certain things that people take as a right that were a right then that were never put in the Constitution because everyone thought that, why bother?
That's a good question. And that question is premised on the argument in the way Justice Scalia, for example, would see it in many respects. There were a lot of things that were seen as rights in those days that they didn't think they were putting in the Constitution. And those rights, as I said, came from common law. They came from court decisions and common practice. And it evolved and changed over time. And so there were plenty of rights, such as the right to own property is not actually mentioned in the Constitution, but they thought they had the right to own property, including other people. And they also knew that there could be restrictions on that property ownership through nuisance laws and other things, and that was not in the Constitution. So they were actually pretty careful about what they thought they were putting in the Constitution and what they thought they were leaving out. It doesn't mean that they thought that they were blotting out things, but they didn't think that they were putting the right to hunt in the Second Amendment. Again, I do urge folks to really look. They really were talking about it as a matter of political power to check the danger of untrammeled federal power. It was kind of a federalism checks and balances issue. Again, the militia was not anything we have now. It was citizen soldiers with private arms. But what they were focused about, what they felt was important enough to put in the Constitution, was that political purpose of gun ownership.
Okay, I may have a partial answer just then, but my question is about Scalia and his approach, his originalism approach, which I've heard many times. I've never heard it explained by him, and I would assume that if he thought that that 2008 decision was basically the apex of his concept of originalism, he might have, gone through some sort of justification with respect to what the framers of our Constitution said. But in your research and your book, you point out that there really wasn't any discussion at all. So did Scalia make any attempt at all to justify why this was such a great example of originalism, or is it just dogma on his part?
He's on the speaking circuit quite a lot, and he's very proud of it. And he says, people say the Constitution is living, and I say the Constitution is dead, dead, dead. And that gets a lot of applause when he says it. Scalia is really a singular figure, I think, in American law and life, in that most people who get into positions of power, they kind of tone it down and compromise, and they don't really have a coherent point of view. He brought in a very coherent point of view and stuck with it. He did not actually, one of the things that's striking about that Heller case was it was the first time he got to write a big opinion after decades on the court, because he would so anger the other justices that they wouldn't let him write the majority opinion for fear that it would drive away the other justices. This is according to all his biographers, and Chief Justice Rehnquist wouldn't let him do it. His argument for originalism was that it was a way to limit the discretion of judges, to keep judges, modern judges, from imposing their own political views on the Constitution. A lot of people, including other conservatives, looked at the Heller case and thought that that was exactly what he was doing. Judge Richard Posner is one of the leading conservative judges in the United States. He was the originator, he's from the University of Chicago, the originator of law and economics, and he was considered one of the great conservative legal minds. He said that the originalism in Heller merely proved the ability of well-staffed courts to engage in constitutional historical snow jobs, was his words. And then Scalia and him really fought, they fought it out, and Scalia called him a liar, and they had blogs. And it's a good, fortunately, they did not have guns. So another judge, Harvey Wilkinson, who was almost appointed to the court by George W. Bush, has been, again, scathing about this question because he thought that this was as loose and political an opinion as Roe versus Wade, which to them, you know, was exactly what they were fighting against. You know, the original intent, the original meaning is really important. First of all, the text is really important. If it says you can only be president when you're 35, it's kind of hard to argue that that means something different now. It means 35. Other parts of the Constitution are either vague, like the 14th Amendment, or confusing, like this one, or self-contradictory. So we've always looked at original intent, but then we've looked at other things too. We've looked at the history since then. We've looked at how the country has changed and evolved. Back then, there was no police force. There were no cities. There were no assault weapons that could have 100 rounds at once. How have things changed? How have they evolved? And what is the meaning and the structure of the government and the structure of the Constitution? This is how most of these decisions get made. A good recent example, just at the very end of this term, was on the kind of obscure issue of whether presidents get to make recess appointments when Congress is out of session. And the question is, when is Congress out of session? And Scalia was angrily dissented and used dictionaries and the whole same thing, but the majority looked at not only what they meant then, but the subsequent 250 years of practice. And that was what was not really, I would argue, not really done right in that opinion. But the holding was not necessarily ultimately inconsistent with both there being a right and there being gun laws, which is in fact more like what has happened since then.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious what the definition of a gun is and how that plays into the whole legal system, because there's a whole range of weapons out there.
Well, right, because what they were focused on was military weapons, muskets. You were required to own a musket. People also had small arms for shooting rabbits on their property or something like that, but that wasn't what they were focused on. They were focused on muskets. Well, what would be a modern version of that? You know, it would be a drone or a bazooka. The very weapons that actually the court has said, oh, yeah, those are still banned. One of the big questions is, well, why are we assuming arms refers just to guns? I mean, people used knives and swords in those days as a military matter. And one of the questions that people debate is, what does bearing arms mean? Now, Scalia and people who take the view that it's always been an individual right in the way we know it now say, well, bearing arms means carrying a gun. What's interesting, and one of the things that makes us all be able to be our own sleuths or originalists, is all this stuff is online now. And you can actually look and see on that issue, especially of what does a phrase like bearing arms mean. What did they mean by that? It's really interesting. Last year, in 2013, the National Archives put online something called the Founders Online. It was the papers, all the papers of the six most famous founders, I guess you'd want to say, Washington and Adams and Jefferson, Hamilton and Madison and Franklin. And you can search for the phrase bear arms or bearing arms. It comes up 153 times total in all their papers. And other than the times where they say, hey, did you see, we have a Second Amendment and here's what it says, every single time was referring to the military. So to them, bear arms seemed to have some specific military meaning, which we might have lost because if we split the words up and don't look at them as they did. But again, I don't think we ought to be bound solely, even though I think that's better originalism, I don't think that is how a modern country ought to govern itself, by trying to divine what they meant back then based on our historical research.
A clarification. During the Revolutionary War, were they just state militias or was there a national army also?
Great question. At first it was state militias. And there's a wonderful book by, you know, when you think of the Minutemen, they were actually organs of the colonial governments. There wasn't just, if you go to the Lexington and Concord battlefield, you know, this is the statue of the sole solitary fighting farmer. But General John Galvin, the former U.S. commander of NATO, has analyzed. It was 14,000 soldiers fighting in a fairly organized military campaign that day from 40,000 militia members who came in organized fashion to fight around Boston at that time. Soon they began to see that this wasn't enough. And the Continental Army was an army. And it involved much longer enlistments, people got paid, it was much more poor people. They weren't all Americans. And then, of course, the French came in. And so there was both an army and the militias. The militias kind of tended the home front. And the army, at Yorktown, the final battle, only one third, I believe, of the American forces were militia. The rest were army.
Any similarities to the National Guard?
So the National Guard, which in its modern form was created in 1903, is what's called, what would have been called by the framers, a select militia. And that what it is it's not professionals, you know, it's people from their private life, but they're trained and they come in for a short period of time every year and they're trained and it's not everybody. And so the National Guard is kind of, you know, the decisions in the 20th century, the ones where I said the Supreme Court had ruled otherwise and heard some hissing, those decisions were all about the National Guard. Those were really, again, not the same thing ultimately as the militia of the 1790s.
We're not, because
they're a narrower group of people. But the militia back then, the theory was it was every man.
Thank you.
Yes?
Hi. So I'm curious about if someone on the, somebody else were, I mean, how much of your book would you consider to be debatable as opposed to your reporting facts that you've researched? I mean, like in other words, I think of, I like what you wrote, but I think of it as possibly controversial amongst some people. And I'm just curious, how do you respond to that kind of, you know, how do people attack you and make it controversial?
So, some of the, I mean, look, anything on this topic is innately controversial. A lot of the reviews have commented and noted that they felt I was trying hard to be balanced, even though I had a point of view. I think the most thoughtful critique was what the first questioner asked, which is, weren't there, even though the framers weren't actually talking about this kind of individual gun right, weren't there other people there who were? And how do you, don't you think there are unenumerated rights that we all like these days, and why isn't this like one of them? That's the kind of argument I think, the argument that I get that kind of almost makes me laugh when I hear it. I've had the opportunity to appear on numerous platforms with, for example, the gentleman who argued the Heller case, Alan Gura, at the Constitution Center in Philadelphia. And he denied vociferously that they'd changed anything. He said, this is the way it's always been. This is the way it's been from the beginning of the country. Everybody always knew that it was an individual right. The Supreme Court always said it was an individual right. Nothing's changed. And the moderator finally said, you know, Mr. Gura, Mr. Waldman has accused you of being the Thurgood Marshall of gun rights. You know, why don't you own that? I can't get into his head, but I'm sure that thought might have occurred to him as well. It has changed, folks. It has changed. After the book was done, I was on a radio program recently, and I heard an incredible tape. It was a commercial from the 1980s. And it said, the Second Amendment, it is ignored by courts. It is derided by all the law professors and scholars. It has no impact. The flickering flame of liberty is about to go out. I'm Charlton Heston. Please join the NRA and help us change how the country sees the Second Amendment. It's amazing. You know, so look, again, I think that what the gun rights community did is entirely, whether you like it or not, in the great stream of how constitutional change happens in America. And pretending that it didn't happen is not really the most useful approach, I would suggest.
Hi, Hi. So I was wondering, you mentioned that there are certain technological ways that we can make guns safer, what those might be, and if there's an angle with working with gun manufacturers or the business angle to this, bypassing maybe some of the policy?
So yes, so there are those angles, there are those technological approaches, and they've gotten quite tangled up both in politics and inevitably in these constitutional issues too. For example, something as simple as trigger locks, which would be shipped with guns, and a number of the gun manufacturers during the Clinton administration agreed to ship trigger locks so that children don't accidentally shoot a playmate. And there was such a rebellion by gun owners against those companies and a threatened boycott that they pulled back and began funding the NRA. Smith & Wesson faced a consumer boycott and began funding the NRA, according to Business Week magazine. Other technological issues include ballistic micro-stamping in California, where you can now trace. It's basically a kind of a mark that goes on a bullet as it leaves a gun, and you can tell, therefore, which gun a bullet came from, which criminal justice experts believe could be really helpful in tracing guns, illegal use of guns. That's being was actually invented by an NRA member, but it's being challenged by gun rights advocates in court. There's the fight that you may have seen recently took on sort of comical aspects with smart guns. You know, I have an iPhone, and it won't go on unless I put my thumbprint on it. It's very simple. It takes about a quarter of a second. There's that same technology for guns, so that guns can only be used by the legitimate owner. And the state of New Jersey had a law saying that when one of those guns got sold anywhere in the United States, then within a year, all the guns sold in New Jersey had to be a smart gun. So when a gun shop in California started to sell that gun, there was a huge uproar, and they pulled the gun off the shelf. And it's a question of whether it was in time. So there are these technological fixes, but this is the fact, is anytime there's a technological fix, anytime there's something that I would think perhaps might be something that would unite people of all sides on this issue, there are some folks, Second Amendment fundamentalists, who say this is a crushing threat to my individual freedom. And that's a relatively new force in American politics, and I think it is unfortunate.
I want to go to the filibuster. It's very frustrating to me to work for campaigns and to elect people, but then have them completely stopped by a Senate rule that is not even in the Constitution, as we're talking about the Constitution. So why? And I also know that the Democrats don't want to get rid of it entirely because they may need to use it, or it might be used against them, and yada, yada, yada.
Right.
But I guess the question I have as a constitutional scholar, why do we continue to allow this? Really important bills are not being passed, like the one that you said was bipartisan, and yet the NRA, that has more money than God, can win just because their people stop the bill from even coming to the floor, or they require 60 votes.
I do care. As I said, if we want to solve the problems, we've got to fix the systems, and that is one of the systems that needs to be fixed. I kind of want to split those two issues. I don't think the NRA wins because it has more money. It wins because of the passion of its members. The NRA isn't that big. It's got about 3 million something members. AARP has 30 million. It's the passion. And there are times when, as in the background check bill, which had the support roughly of 90% of the public, where it was the passion of the opponents trumped the broad but not so focused support. That's a kind of classic conundrum of political science. Now, to me, I don't think the answer for American democracy comes from having more single interest groups voting only on one issue on all different sides. But it's not, to me, it's not, I get asked this question a lot. The NRA does not win because of its PAC is bigger than everybody else's PAC. It's because the membership votes and cares a lot and is very deeply concerned about this. But you're exactly right about the filibuster. You know, when you do go back and read the notes from the Constitutional Convention, they were very aware of the dangers of requiring supermajorities in the legislature. They knew that republics failed when they required a supermajority. They put in supermajorities for things like treaties, explicitly because they did not expect there to be that requirement any other time. And this is something, folks, that has changed a lot, and we don't even realize it. There were more filibusters in the last decade than the previous two centuries of the country put together. And the Senate and both sides have done it. Lately, the Republicans have been doing it much, much more. The Democrats may find themselves doing it too if they are in the minority. It is deeply destructive of the governability of the country. The Senate did change one part of Rule 22, as it's called. It made it possible to get nominations through. Even the most non-controversial of nominations were being filibustered for a year or two for ambassadorships, for these jobs no one ever heard of. Just because, in this instance, because the Senate minority wanted to gum up the works and deny President Obama any victories on anything. I would like to see much stronger change in Rule 22, in this filibuster rule. I'd like to see it that you have require 60 votes the first time, and then the second time you have to have 57 votes, and the third time you have to have 54 votes, and then finally you can pass a bill with a majority. That would slow things down. That would bring bad legislation into the public light, but it would mean that you could actually pass some legislation. You know, George Washington is quoted as describing the Senate. They say, well, he said the Senate is like with a hot cup of coffee. You pour the coffee into the saucer to cool it. That's the Senate. Well, he said to cool it. He didn't say to throw it out. And that's what's been going on. And I'm afraid it will. You could do it by, I don't want to get too much into the weeds. This is what's called the nuclear option. The Senate requires 67 votes to change its own rules, except sometimes they actually change the rule on the nominations but without that. But in the first minute of the first day of the new Senate in January, they can do 51 votes and they vote for new rules. And that's when it would have to happen. And I have not the slightest doubt that if the Republicans win, they will dramatically reform the filibuster. And people like me, who strongly supports it now, if I don't strongly support it next year, then I'm a hypocrite. So I think the country works better when people get elected and they get to do the stuff they say they want to do, and then they bear the consequences.
Actually, I think they were waiting before me.
I know I'm not in New York now.
That's, yeah. Well, that was really polite of you. Thank you. So the media tends to phrase mass shootings, school shootings, gun violence as what's wrong with our kids today. But if we're being honest about it, we can't really use gender neutral terms concerning this. And, you know, women and men have equal access to guns, and we don't see them equally going on mass shootings. So I'm wondering if you've delved into what role gender plays into gun violence.
It's a great question. You know, it's gender, it's race, actually. White men are more likely to own guns than any other group by far. I think that we kind of assume all this. We assume the gender and assume that that's just boys will be boys, you know. But this goes into the political fight. I think that the recent fiasco of the open carry movement in Texas might potentially mark an interesting political turning. As a lot of you know, so again, some places there's Washington State, you can both open carry and carry concealed weapon, is my understanding. In Texas, there's a movement to try to liberalize the gun laws, and people, the way they're doing it is the open carry movement is they take assault weapons into Chipotle restaurants and Target stores and other places, especially places where women are shopping, and videotape it. And the NRA did a blog post saying this is really weird and very self-destructive and they shouldn't do this. And the person who did the blog post was rebuked. They apologized for it and pulled it off the internet. But I really think there is potentially a silent majority of women who look at that and have a very different reaction to it, perhaps, than men do. So,
yeah,
you know,
I'd also say, though, gun manufacturers are getting increasingly perverse. I mean, they're actually starting to market to girls and have made pink firearms because they want them to think it's a toy and it's pretty and cute. I think there's something drastically wrong with a country that, you know, says that you need to have a license for a car, you need to be 21 to drink alcohol. And, you know, I'm not trying to bash rural culture. And, you know, I think if you have a responsible adult with you, I'm not trying to do that. But I do think there's something really wrong with trying to glamorize guns for children. And I don't know what to do. I don't know what, it's like, I don't know what the solution is. I don't know if there's a solution. I thought that, you know, with the shootings and all the recent school shootings, that would have turned a corner, and it hasn't. So I don't know. I'm sorry. I feel pretty hopeless.
Well, I think the answer has to come from understanding that this is a long-term issue, and that we as a country go through these spasms of remorse and focus, and then we turn to other things. It used to be political assassinations. Gun laws were, federal gun laws gained a lot of momentum in the 1960s when it was revealed that Lee Harvey Oswald bought his gun through the NRA magazine, the American Rifleman, and that led to a lot of gun laws then. But the country can't just go through these spasms and then walk away. So I think whatever side anyone is on this, this is a long-term debate. It's been part of, you know, it has as much to do, you mentioned gender, it also really has as much to do with people's attitude toward government and individual rights as relates to government as anything else. And it's really woven into the whole fabric of how we think of ourselves as a country. But it's not, there's never going to be a solution to it one way or the other. It's always going to be a debate.
A fight, yeah.
Thank you. We always seem to see, I shouldn't say we, but at least myself or anyway, I always notice whenever kind of gun argument or gun issue comes up, there's always this relationship between the NRA and gun manufacturers. And the claim from one side is saying we're representing the gun manufacturing industry. The other side, the same side says, well, we're representing our members, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. There seems to be some finger pointing when it comes to the issue of gun safety, as in who's really pushing who. Would you care to comment on that relationship?
You know, again, I don't pretend to have either personal or journalistic knowledge of it. What I've read and what I understand is that the driving force tends to be more the members. The gun manufacturer's financial support for gun rights groups is at a significant level is a relatively recent thing. Although it's interesting, if you look at the, you know, I described how there have been gun laws all throughout the country's history. In the early 20th century, when people moved into cities, there were gun laws banning the carrying of revolvers, especially in states and especially in cities. That came out of a political assassination of the attempted shooting of the mayor of New York. And if you read the debate in the Albany legislature over that first modern 20th century gun law, the gun manufacturers were the lobbyists against it, the upstate New York gun factories. I think this is more, I could be wrong, but I think this is more about culture and people's sense of values than about the economics of the gun industry. It is interesting, though, that there are ways in which some of these economic issues will play out as legislation is stymied. The reason that fast food chains and other consumer retail chains and stores have asked that people not bring firearms in, it may be because of their values, but it's as much their fear of liability as anything else. Because one mass shooting in a coffee chain could be very damaging to that.
To that end, are you afraid? Well, I shouldn't say afraid, but do you have any thoughts on the idea that if Chipotle actually took on the NRA? Because it appears to me that you have a private industry making a request of its patrons versus people who are saying you should boycott this restaurant, which strangely enough, they're saying you should boycott a restaurant for behaving responsibly, which is an entirely different question from legislation, which is what they don't want in the first place.
I'll think about that.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Waldman, I'm with Washington Ceasefire, and I want to thank you for coming. We've made your book required reading for everybody on our group, and for all of us here on the front line of this issue, we owe you a big, big debt of gratitude. My question is, with your work and with history as hindsight on this, what kind of grade do you give the lawyers who are arguing for the legacy interpretation of this issue?
You know, the lawyers who argued for the legacy interpretation, they kind of they were behind the other side by several decades because it was so much the settled understanding.
Yeah.
They didn't do, for example, the historical research. Only in the last decade has there been ample historical research showing the web of gun control laws throughout the country's history that I mentioned. And, for example, is a very well-regarded historian named Saul Cornell at Fordham, who has done a lot of the pioneering work on this. You know, it didn't used to be that you had to be looking at colonial gun practices to prove mm-hmm. your point. Mm-hmm. There needs to be jurisprudential work. There needs to be historical research. There needs to be the kind of enlisting of the private bar through pro bono mm-hmm. work that you see in all kinds of issues, civil rights laws and other things like that, where there are lawyers who help. And this is starting to happen, and actually the group that Mayor Bloomberg founded is deeply involved yeah. in this, and some of the other groups are getting geared up.
Yeah.
But it didn't used to be the case that you need to worry about the court so much. So, you know.
And if they had done all this research, do you think it would have mattered, or do you think Justice Scalia and others were just preordained to interpret this the way they saw fit, given?
Well, the so there were so in the Heller case, for example, there was the majority opinion, which was the five justices, and that was the first of the 5-4, the big 5-4 rulings that this court has made that we're very familiar with now. Mm-hmm. Citizens United came after that, and Shelby County and Hobby Lobby, a lot of the cases that are very controversial since. It's the same five. There were two dissents. One was by Justice Stevens, mm-hmm. And that was he tried to be an originalist too, mm-hmm. and he went at it the same way Scalia did. Now, I thought he had the better of the historical argument, mm-hmm. but he basically tried to do it the same way. There was a third opinion, which was the dissent by Justice Breyer. And Breyer, who's a little bit of a technocrat sometimes on these things, said, okay, let's stipulate as an individual right. What then? That's the beginning of the analysis. How do we decide what laws can be upheld or struck down? He said that judges would have to perform a balancing test, and because the right people to do the balancing are actually legislators, the public, not judges, right. he voted against the majority.
Right.
But it's actually Breyer's dissent, in many respects, has had a bigger impact than the historicism of the Heller majority.
So there's some winning from losing here in the end, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the judges around the country have kind of looked at it the way they look at the First Amendment or one of these other rights. And they say, well, what level of scrutiny do we use and other things? These are tools they use all the time to assess when rights are absolute and when they're limited.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much.
Okay, quickly. To what degree does constitutional change being affected by the removal of the threat? In this particular case, the threat was a fear of a strong central government, or actually a fear of a king. And I can think we could probably argue that for 250 years we've proved that the central government in our country is not going to go over and act like a king and take away rights because there's too many checks and balances. And the other part of that is the removal of the need. There was obviously a need to hunt. And we've had to have weapons up until that time to survive. But those kind of needs have gone. So what degree of constitutional change is going to be affected by this?
It's a great question. And I don't think we entirely know. I think that, and again, some people... former Congressman Joe Scarborough, who has the Republican congressman who has the show on MSNBC in the morning, he believes that the Heller case, the codification of the individual right view actually takes away people's fear of that threat from people who are worried that that tyrannical central government will confiscate their weapons, and actually makes it easier for somebody like him to support something like an assault weapons ban. One of the other threats that drives people in this is actually fear of social disorder and crime. It both drives people wanting to have guns and feeling that there's chaos and social disorder that they have to protect themselves against. And if you hear Wayne LaPierre talk, he still talks that way. And it also drives people who think there's too much crime. Gun crime is actually way down in the United States over the last 20, 30 years. So a lot of the a lot of the underlying perceived threats in all directions may be diminishing and minimizing, which is why I don't want to see things locked in now through a rigidity in the constitutional doctrine that we are going to potentially work out through other more democratically accountable means.
So that was quite kind of my question. That gun rights, or gun fetishists, as I call them, point to the fear of a tyrannical government, and that's why they're morally entitled to take the positions they take. Do you have a bumper sticker response to that?
No. So they were emphatically thinking about fighting political tyranny. So why then isn't somebody like Cliven Bundy today right? He says, I don't have to listen to the government. I don't like the laws. Yeah, I owe all these grazing fees. As Bill O'Reilly put it on Fox, he's the biggest scofflaw in the United States. But I'm like the founding fathers. I'm standing up with my weaponry against the tyrannical central government. That's what he said. It actually reflects a widespread, but I would suggest largely mistaken, understanding of what the framers meant by standing up to tyranny. There were definitely people then who thought that anybody with their gun could decide what they were going to stand up and fight. That was Shay's Rebellion. The framers actually wrote the Constitution because they didn't believe that that was how it ought to work. They believed there needed to be some order and some legitimate military force and civic force, governmental authority, and not everybody deciding themselves who they could, at what moment they would have an insurrection against the government. How do we know this? Among the ways we know this is what happened while the Second Amendment was being ratified. The Whiskey Rebellion, it's like Shay's Rebellion. The farmers in western Pennsylvania didn't want to pay the whiskey tax, which was, they saw as tyrannical, and they said, we're back in the saddle, we're going to rebel. And George Washington showed up with the militia, said, you well-regulated militia team, this is how we're doing it from now on. So, you know, this goes to the question of what was the original intent. There were certainly people, and, you know, you can find newspaper articles from the time and so on that said that everybody should be able to make these decisions on their own, but so it is hard to fully understand one voice from that period, but pretty clearly they were trying to create a workable government. And so I don't think that, I go back to, I don't want to be governed by some phony baloney notion of what the founders really meant. It's not a way to run a modern country. And I don't think most of us really would think it was how we wanted to live now. Yes? Well, okay. So thank you all so very much.